This Life Matters program was live yesterday morning. We can't take your calls now, but enjoy the conversation. Good morning and welcome to Life Matters with me, Ellen Fanning. I've spent the past few hours writing this program for you. Senior experienced producers have spent their working lives considering how to shape a program for you that touches on the lived experience of Australians, social change and social policy in a way that's entertaining, informative, and occasionally uncomfortable. This morning, for instance, our program includes what to do when your teenage daughter gets a tattoo and an interview with an Australian doctor on the front line in Syria. We'll get to those in a minute. But see, as you listeners know, what we're doing here this morning and every morning is drawing on a tradition that began a generation ago when a group of women like Anne Deveson, who died yesterday at the age of 86, wrestled such issues from the women's pages into the mainstream. Her focus was the cut and thrust of life in all its messiness and imperfection. Stories about our society rather than the economy, about the powerless rather than the powerful. Forget the trivia of how to dress for hubby when he arrives home and five ways with leftovers, all on the inside pages of the 1960s newspapers. Instead, Anne helped to elevate issues affecting women, children, families, the disabled, gay and lesbian Australians. Anne was born in Kuala Lumpur in what was then Malaya. She made a name as a broadcaster on Australian commercial radio and TV, became infamous for those Omo ads where she'd pop over the hedge to ask an unsuspecting housewife, "What washing powder are you using?" And then she became known as a mental health campaigner, in part because of the terrible struggle her late son Jonathan had with schizophrenia. Her daughter, the novelist Georgia Blaine, died just last week at the age of 51 of a brain tumour. A fight with that she'd been chronicling in the Saturday paper for some months. Anne is survived by her son Joshua. Anne Deveson, AO, was an optimist, a warrior for social change and a better world. Here she is in 2004 talking to Robin Hughes about what she called the dreaded Omo commercials, about her involvement with 1970s politics, the Vietnam War, and the so-called Green Bans, that union-led campaign to preserve Victorian-era buildings in Sydney. And she also talks about her daily program on Sydney's 2GB, a radio station that today no longer has any women in its regular weekday lineup. Here's Anne.
Well, I did a daily program. Then I did political interviews after the news, and they got a lot of publicity. I covered quite a lot of controversial subjects. And that, I think, was another pivotal point in my life, really, in that those programs and the documentaries which I continued to make were mainly about social issues. And what it did for me, who in a way had led a fairly protected life, in a funny way, maybe I hadn't in my childhood, but what it did to me was that it took me out into the streets, or I heard coming through my ears the voices of people who were struggling with poverty, who were struggling with illegal abortions, who were struggling with children who had handicaps and when there was no help available for them. So I became much more aware of people who were leading very different lives, for whom it wasn't the lucky country. And that, I think, started to politicise me, perhaps in a way that I hadn't been politicised before. I became involved in the Vietnam War movement, and in a number of social issues, the Green Bans, all sorts of things like that. So it was quite an important part in my life, and because it was daily, it was probably more important even than the documentaries, although they also immersed me in all sorts of facets of life that mightn't have happened otherwise.
The documentaries you made at that stage, were they mostly for Channel 7 for 7 days?
Yes, I think a couple were for the ABC. I did one on children with handicaps, but mostly they were for Channel 7. Later, I went on to make documentaries for 9 and the ABC, but that was later in my career. I think I was lucky in that this happened at a time when there were not many women. So if you were any good, and I was quite good, then I got opportunities very quickly in a way that mightn't have happened later. I don't know.
Now, what brought your time at 2GB to an end?
In the beginning, I had no idea. I went in to work one day and I heard them discussing in the room next, or the pig pen next to us, and I'll explain that in a minute, what they were going to do with my program the following week. And 2GB had fairly recently moved to new buildings in Sussex Street or Kent Street, and it was all open plan, and we each had what I used to call the pig pens, which were open plan offices with kind of low purple velvet or plum velvet bars that separated us off, I think. It's my fantasy anyway. And then the green bands were on. There was the whole hoo-ha about development down at the Rocks and up in Victoria Street in Potts Point. And I became involved in backing that. And because I was there as a personality, quote unquote, where I was expected to have an opinion, I wasn't a news journalist, I held forth loud and strong about kicking the original residents out of the Rocks, about sending them out to Whoop Whoop, and about the kinds of development that were planned, which were totally alien to the environment and very ugly. And although I had been able to talk about the Vietnam War and to get away with it, even though management would say that was a very tough program, dear, and management won't like that, dear, nevertheless, I had very high ratings, so they left me alone, as they did Brown White. But came the green bands, the people who didn't like it were not so much management, although they didn't like it either, when they found out that all their advertisers, many of whom had direct interest in these developments that were going on, didn't like it one little bit, and they kept complaining. And I got warned that I mustn't cover this particular subject anymore. And I remember saying, I don't feel that I can do this. I've already become involved. I think it's a very important social and political issue, and I will continue. So I was kind of asking for it. And I came in one day and I heard this conversation, and I went in and said, what's happening? And I was told that they had recently done a survey, and they found that women only wanted to listen to light music the particular time of my program, and therefore they had decided that it was time that I ended my contract. And what happened after that was gloriously satisfying for 24 hours only, but at the time it meant that there was a big demonstration. So on my final day of work, of broadcasting, it was at lunchtime, there was a big demonstration. The women's electoral lobby, the trade unions, the Handicapped Children's Association, the Autistic Children's Association, the mental health branch, all these groups came with placards and paraded around the whole building saying, "And for lunch." And then they went into the building and came into the studio. Management, meanwhile, which wasn't very large, abandoned the building and called in the Commonwealth Police. So I got enormous television coverage, and I had my hour of glory when, you know, it was on the news that night, and even a bit of it dribbled through to the news the following morning. But then, of course, I found I was without a job. I was unemployed. And that was an extraordinary experience and a very illuminating one, because I hadn't realized how much my identity was bound up with my work. And it was the sort of thing that then I'd talk in sometimes in fairly critical terms about these men whose identity solely rests with their work. And I realized that without my work, that I felt depleted in some way. I felt my identity very fragile, and I didn't like it at all, not at all.
Why do you say the dreaded Omo?
Ah, because it's followed me and plagued me all my life, I suppose. And there was a period when I was a bit kind of snobby about it and I didn't want to talk about it. And I think my attitude now is that it was part of my life and I did it. I was a commercial animal in the sense that I was working for a commercial broadcasting organization. I couldn't work for the ABC. I did commercial television. And when I was asked to do these for quite a lot of money, I thought, why not? Later, I regretted it. My role was to stalk the suburbs or appear suddenly over the sand dunes and shove a mic under somebody's nose and say, what washing powder do you use? I was very English then in those commercials. And I remember Barry Humphries took me off, included me in one of his skits at the Theatre Royal. And we sat in the front seat while we watched Barry playing the Omo lady. I had a return run of doing three Omo commercials, which kind of kept me going while Jonathan was so ill in the beginning. But that was a phase in my life where I remember Stuart Wagstaff, who used to do Benson and Hedges, telling me, do it by all means, but it will follow you to the grave.
But you were able to make documentaries for news division of Channel 7 on social issues in a way that doesn't seem to happen so much these days. Have you noticed a change between then and now in the focus in commercial television?
Well, I think commercial television is much more infotainment stuff, but I think that's not just commercial television. I think there's been a general dumbing down. I think it applies equally to the ABC. But there was then a very strong documentary unit at Channel 7 that was headed by Peter Westaway. He was very bright and he did give support for anything, any good idea that people came up with. And he was prepared to take risks. He was prepared to do stuff that might attract a lot of, you know, angry correspondents afterwards. I did one on lesbians and, you know, got correspondents saying, this is a disgusting subject, and, you know, and how dare you let this sort of filth be aired on television, and so on and so on. But he always backed us.
During that period also, the whole idea of talkback started. Were you involved in that?
Yes, I was, and I think I was one of the first to use talkback. I was certainly the first on 2GB, and I remember being, we were all drilled in how to use talkback and the fact that there was a panic button and there was a 7 seconds delay between the actual broadcasting, the actual taping of the recording and going to air. And I hit off on the first morning, and I had my colleagues and the managing director and the admin manager and everybody standing behind the glass panel watching to make sure nothing went wrong. And for the first hour, my finger was hovering over the panic button. Every time anyone said anything to do with sex or sex or sex, my finger would be there. And at the end of an hour, a man was droning on very boringly about the price of cauliflowers. And in the middle of this, he suddenly said, without changing the tone of his voice, exactly what he would like to do with me, for me, and to me sexually. And instead of pressing the panic button, I was so amazed. I said, would you mind repeating that? And he did. So all hell broke loose afterwards from a broadcasting control board that obviously didn't have much sense of humour. But it was shows that you can't always be prepared.
No, you can't. Anne Deveson talking there to Robin Hughes as part of the Australian Biography series. If you want to listen to the whole interview, go to australianbiography.gov.au. Just search for Anne Deveson, where it will tell you that despite the wonderful English voice, she was in fact born in 1930 in Kuala Lumpur in what was then Malaya. Wendy McCarthy is a businesswoman, a campaigner for the rights of women, and was Anne's friend. She's with me now. Wendy, I'm so sorry that you've had to deal with Anne's loss at a personal level as well as losing such a giant of the media and social campaigning and change. I'm so sorry.
Thank you. And I must say this morning when I heard the news that and compounded with Georgia, I thought, it's really too much sadness for anyone. I just felt like sort of putting the doona over my head for the rest of the day, because I feel, I mean, in some ways we lost Anne quite a while ago because Alzheimer's claimed it. And I found myself sort of revisiting, you know, with Hazel and thinking of long life friendships and the coming and going of them and how women's friendships are so strong. And I haven't seen a lot of Anne in the last decade, but my God, she was such a heroine. She's 10 years older than me. And when I was a young feminist, I used to listen to her on radio, and I felt that she, in today's parlance, had it all. She had that fabulous broadcasting voice, and just listening to the archival bit, you know, I'm finding myself, you know, swept with a million memories and thinking about, you know, when I used to listen to her, then I met her. I was in that demo outside when she lost the job.
Of course you were. You lined up at 2GB, did you, to join the picket with the Women's Electoral Lobby and the trade unions?
I was one of the founders of the Women's Electoral Lobby. So, of course, and it reminds you how different the world was and how differently women did things. We just went, you know, we had a telephone tree, you know, we were the get-up of our time. I rang someone and she had to ring six people and she had to ring six people. And suddenly there was a demo. We could call a demo in about, you know, an hour. We could get a demo going. And it was so amazing. And, of course, she, you know, in some ways, like she was a big girl. 10 years is a big difference when you're 26. And then I got to know her. And, of course, you know, she did the Royal Commission on Human Relationships. And I started working in childbirth education and family planning. So I just gravitated to her and to her experiences, you know, which were sort of all about 10 years ahead of mine. And then we became very good friends, and I sort of used to see her when she was in Adelaide. And then there was the terrible, and of course I always listened to her on radio, because she took to radio and paraphrased on radio the experiences of people like me, that newly educated cohort of women in Australia, who were searching for more than being at home with a baby, even a baby they adored, even if they're lucky enough with a partner they adored, but there had to be more than life. And where did you express your social contract? I'm educated by the state. What do I put back? And she gave us all sorts of opportunities to do that.
So what did you hear? You're home alone, you're 26, you're home alone with the baby, you turn on the 2GB morning program. What is she saying that suddenly makes you stop and listen?
Well, first of all, a woman's voice, although there were a couple of others. There was Andrea. I think what I heard was, to have a full life, you don't have to put yourself in one compartment just because you got married or just because you had a baby, that you can still be a whole person. It's what I'd say to young women today: take your whole self to work. You don't have to. You might have to be professional as you cross the door, and you will be, but you don't have to compartmentalise yourself to such a point that you can't take those values with you and begin to change them. And so, you know, I was part of the lobby group for childbirth and then abortion law reform, and, the, you know, one of the people out there supporting, encouraging. And then, you know, I end up in mental health for, you know, 8 years with Headspace, some 50 years later or 20, 40 years later. And I think she paved the way for engagement. And I heard that it was possible to be a member of the community, an active member of community, engaged in change and a better world, despite the fact that I didn't have a job for 8 years.
She was unusual in being a working woman, a full-time working woman with children. There wasn't much childcare to speak of, was there? And she had two high-needs children, Joshua and Jonathan, as well as her daughter, Georgia, who passed away last week. She had so much going on in her life.
Yes, but they weren't high-needs children in the beginning. You know, that came later in life. So for the 0 to 6s, the 0 to 5s, no, there was almost no early learning possibilities or childcare available, and mostly it was home-based care. But she didn't make a feature of it. She said, you know, children will enhance my life, as I believe my children have enhanced my life, And that doesn't mean I can't be an active member of society. But of course, when we say that women didn't work, we're talking about women like us. There were still hundreds of women working in factories and other places who had nothing compared with us, and they didn't even have the luxury and choice of sitting home listening to Anne like I did. Mm. And we just need to remember that. But she was the role model out in front.
In 1975, she started work on the Royal Commission on Human Relationships. What a wonderful thing. The notion that you would use all the powers of a royal commission to look at human relationships. She wrote at the time, and she says in that interview in the Australian Biography series, she quotes Winston Churchill, that royal commissions are like the ink in cuttlefish. They serve to conceal rather than reveal. So she knew that was the risk. And instead, she says she got a crash course in sociology, not by sitting in a courtroom waiting for people to come, but by going out with the other commissioners and interviewing thousands of people about the social revolution that was starting to happen. She spoke to women with children with disabilities, people with cerebral palsy, Indigenous people, people trying to organise medical practices.
Yeah.
Why was this? I mean, how was this possible? Who conceives of the idea?
Gough Whitlam. That's all. It was a Whitlam thing. How do you reset the framework of relationships between men and women in this country? Can't you hear his voice? And so he gave it to a bishop, and he had people like Joan Bielski and Robin Sexton, who's now family court judge. Joan Bielski, a wonderful feminist. Anne was there as a commissioner, and the bishop, and another person whose name escapes me, I think it was Rhonda Wilson. And their task was to take apart the existing views on society and look at what, or the traditional views, and look at how people want to change. Those changes are still being reverberated now. It changed the way we looked at family planning and funded it. And Gough funded family planning, you know, it's significant money for family planning. It changed the way we looked at homosexuality and whether there should be laws against it. I mean, he would have dealt with marriage, they would have dealt with marriage equality, of course, you know, in today's world. But it's like chaos theory. They kind of turned everything upside down and they think, where will it settle and where should it settle?
All with the powers of a royal commission where you can compel witnesses.
Fantastic thing to do. And then it's, you know, as I said, anti-discrimination legislation was discussed there, you know, should you have legal certainty around discrimination? It was an extraordinary thing. I went back and read a lot of the findings about 5 years ago when I was writing something. And I'd been sort of, we had the Royal Commission, but you forget some of the work that was done in the 70s. And it was around Family Law Act, of course, Elizabeth Evatt chaired it. And Elizabeth Evatt then went on to become the first head of the Family Law Court.
So many achievements, but one facet of her work that many listeners will remember was her seminal book about her son, Jonathan, and his terrible struggle with schizophrenia. The book was called Tell Me I'm Here. What was so important about that book?
I think it was an attempt by a parent to move into Jonathan's shoes and to try, and other parents' shoes, and to try and share the pain, experience, the guilt, the love, the sadness, the tragedy of a life with a very troubled young man. And you know, I know after 10 years with Headspace and thinking about it, how if one in four people suffer from mental health, a lot, we can go back to Anne Deveson and say that she took the blowtorch into the lives of people struggling with mental health. And I remember there at one stage when she was doing an interview and a woman said to me, you know, I'll do anything to stay alive because I have a child with a mental illness. And I don't want that child going into a home. And I've always, you know, always been sort of haunted by the idea what can happen. But Anne was so astonished when all these people on the street came to Jonathan's funeral. But she, you know, she was honest about it, the violence, the ugliness, and the love and the compassion and the constant searching for a solution. I think it was an extraordinary achievement to write that book.
She did very much share as she became more an activist than a journalist, but certainly there was that raw quality to the sharing that she did about schizophrenia and life in all its messiness. And I guess as well as the media work and the work of the Royal Commission and the heavy work of setting up organisations to support people with a mental illness, that is her legacy.
And he was also an extraordinarily generous host. And I just, when I heard it, I went and got one of my book I wrote, and there's a photograph of her, there's 16 women, all women for Whig, campaigning for the Whig legislation in her home. And she always had like beautiful houses. And everyone would go there. And her house would be part of it, whatever the movement was at the time. So here we are all lined up, you know, she calls it, journalist and gets the story written about why it's important for the Whig legislation was important for women. And that part of her ought never to be forgotten either, because in the last years of her life closed down socially and only very few friends saw her, when that part of her life finished and she was, you know, still with us, she said that was one of the sadnesses she missed. And as I get older, I understand that. Mm. You know, it's not, you are no longer the central feature in a movement and you have to learn to live differently.
Yes.
And I often think about her and how she managed that and how beautifully she did it. And, you know, so there she is, she's still 10 years ahead.
Thank you so much, Wendy, from coming out from under the doona after learning of the death of Anne Deveson and indeed her daughter, the novelist Georgia Blaine, who died just last week of the age of 51.
And thanks for doing this. Thanks for doing this for Anne.
Wonderful.
Helen. Okay. Terrific.
Bye. Wendy McCarthy, businesswoman, campaigner for the rights of women, talking about the enormous legacy of her friend, the late Anne Deveson, who passed away yesterday. We owe her so much. As a broadcaster, I say that, but also as an Australian. Anne Deveson, you're listening to Life Matters. But I'm still there for you, with a long, long way to go, until I make my brother understand. Oh, yes, I was, but it's wisdom for the pain. Yes, I pay the price, but look how much I've gained. If I have to, I can face anything. I am strong, strong. I am invincible, invincible. I am woman, I am woman, I am woman, I am woman, I am strong, I am woman, I am woman. Thank you. Now, a story Anne Deveson would have loved. Getting inked, the tattoo, is a much more common life milestone than it's ever been before. One in four Australian women, a quarter of Australian women, have a tattoo, and one in five adults. It was once the realm of sailors and bikies, but tattoos have well and truly jumped into the mainstream in the last decade. What stories do they tell us? They can mark, I suppose, places and times in our lives, an end or a beginning, or simply that, you know, we had a few too many drinks and we had a spare $35 and gosh, look at that on my arm. We want to hear your stories. When did you first get your tattoo? How did your parents react? Or if you're a parent, have you had to come to terms with your child's tattoo or tattoos? Did you embrace it? Or perhaps you had to come out and tell your own parents about your tattoos. And why did you get one? 1300 225 576, 1300 225 576, or you can text me 0418 226 576, 0418 226 576. Send us your tattoo as well to the Life Matters Facebook page. We'd love to have a look. That's our topic this morning, revealing your tattoos. Sophie Townsend and Claire Stendel are a mother and daughter who've been having this conversation about what's that on your upper arm, my dear. Good morning to you both.
Hi, Eleni.
We've also invited a tattoo historian, Simon Barnard, along to talk about convict tattoos and their history. Simon, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, but I just want you to sit there quietly while we just have a little chat. Sure. Here to young Claire. Now, Claire, Let's just be quite calm. Take me to the beginning. You sent your mother a text a couple of weeks ago. What did you say in the text, Claire?
I said, all right, I've got a tattoo.
That's it?
That's it.
Was there a picture with it?
No, there was not. That came later.
Right. Now, Claire, you are a school student at the moment, 16 years old?
Yes, 16.
And you're in year 9?
10.
You're in year 10. Okay. And where were you, when you were sending this text?
I was in Summer Hill.
Okay. And you had been to school? What day of the week is it?
I had been to school.
Why do I sound like a police officer?
It'd been Tuesday.
It's a Tuesday?
Yes.
At what time of the day?
Oh, it would have been 4-ish.
4-ish. So
maybe
just
5?
After school? Just after school.
Yes.
Long
it was
enough
later
to...
than that. It was about 5, I think.
Yeah, well, 4 or 5, you know.
And at what stage had you got the tattoo?
Right after school.
So sometime between 3:15 and when you sent the text, you've got a tattoo.
Yes.
All right. And now you've texted Mum to say?
Got a tattoo.
Got a tattoo. Mum. Okay.
Yeah, so at this stage I'd had a very hard day, very hard week at work actually, and was relaxing with a friend from work with a drink.
Right. Lucky.
Yeah. And picked up my phone, saw the text. My first thought was, does a good mother rush home? Because there's nothing you can do, right?
It's so permanent.
Do I rush home or do I finish my drink and order several more to get over it and then go back feeling a little more relaxed?
So what did you do?
I did what any good mother would do and I stayed.
And had another drink.
Yeah.
Right. And so, Claire, why did you do it?
Well, you know, I just wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the word. There's not an awful lot of deep meaning behind it.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, you know, wanted it, yeah.
So if the listener was in here with us and they looked at your left arm,
mm-hmm.
Underneath your armpit, on your inner arm, the top of your arm, what's the word?
Peachy.
And it's a well-done tattoo, is it?
Yes.
It looks very good, I have to say. Who did it for you?
Mate from school.
And Claire said he is so hygienic, it was ridiculous.
Right.
So I feel fine.
How did the mate from school come to know how to do a hygienic good tattoo that says peachy?
They have a tattoo gun, so.
Okay. And is this a thing that young people do a lot? In your circle?
No, it's not. I mean, you know, every so often maybe one in, I don't know, but
okay,
it's not very common.
And then you get home and, Sophie, you've had a couple of wines and steadied yourself. How did the conversation unfold?
Well, it is a bit hard because it's there's nothing to be done really except, you know, laser surgery, but even that can't be done at the time. So I didn't want to get hysterical.
Right.
I wanted to be cool and accepting, but I also was just a little cranky. So it was just a lot of emotions. I have a 13-year-old as well who was suggesting various punishments
What was the suggestions?
Oh, grounding for a month, no pocket money. You know, there were several things, but then, you know, each time she'd suggest something, I'd say, well, you should be grounded too for breaking your phone. And, you know, so she stopped that. And in the end, I think, you know, Claire is a fabulous kid. She does well at school. She's funny. She helps out. She's probably not as tidy as she should be, but, you know, like in the scheme of things, peachy on her arm is not quite that bad. Her grandparents, however, were shocked and appalled. And because when I got my tattoo, they were equally shocked.
Excuse me?
Yes.
When you got your what?
I have a tattoo.
You have a tattoo?
I
hang on a sec here. Wait a minute, Claire, what is she reacting like this when she's got a tattoo?
Exactly.
Did you point this out?
I may have.
And I also pointed out that I was 40 and didn't need my parents' permission when I got it.
Right.
So, You know, like I also drive a car and I don't expect her to do that, and I drink wine and I don't, you know, it's not quite fair, the fact that I have a tattoo, she should get a tattoo.
Does that seem slightly hypocritical to you, Claire?
You know, I see where she's coming from and it does make sense. A touch, maybe.
Michelle's on the line from Tasmania. Michelle, your daughter got a tattoo. Where did she get it?
Good morning. She got a tattoo on the top of her left foot.
Seems fair enough. What does it say?
It doesn't say anything, but she embraced her heritage and culture, and my heritage is Maltese and my husband's heritage is English-German. So she had the Maltese cross with an anchor and rosary beads, as we're also Catholic. So I think she thought that ticked all the boxes.
Well, you must have been thrilled with the rosary beads at least. At least she can go to Mass on the weekend and stride in. How did you react?
Well, I was very cross because I did really know that she probably would eventually get a tattoo, but I did say to our children that if they were to get one, they could get the blood group, their blood group, on the bottom of their foot. So
oh, that's exciting.
And I said, the only tattoo you can have is your blood group on the bottom of your foot. But my husband did know, and they didn't share it with me, but I did tweet because we are very close. And I thought it was just really strange that she hadn't touched base for a little bit. And I thought, click. And then I realised, so I was probably actually a bit more cross with my husband for not letting me know, but I didn't talk to my daughter for 2 days and she was devastated that I didn't do that. And I just said, well, you know, it is a very permanent thing. And yes, our other child, our other adult child is a boy and he has tattoos as well. It is, I'm a bit of a clean skin, I like to say.
Yes. You still don't quite approve, but you're getting used to it. Thanks, Michelle, for that call. A couple on the text service. Tattoos. My beautiful young daughter rang me a year ago to tell me she was getting a tattoo. She wanted to explain it before she got it. She wasn't asking permission, just discussing as adults. I told her I did not like but respected and loved her. Happy to talk, says Arthur. Another on the text service says, I got my first tattoo at 17 to piss people off and now I want them removed. Oh, somebody else is calling it a tramp stamp. How dreadful. What a dreadful thing to say. They say you shouldn't get a tattoo, says another, because you'll regret it when you're old. So I waited until I turned 60. But when I turned 60, every second 15-year-old girl has a tattoo. That put me right off, but I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I didn't do it. Also on the line we have Simon Barnard, who is a tattoo historian. Now, take me back to the records of the 10,000 convicts transported to Van Diemen's Land between 1823 and 1853. Simon, presumably they had these conversations with their parents about their tattoos.
Oh, well, probably not. They probably got them, most of them probably got them on the voyage over in lieu of no parents.
And what were these tattoos like? Because when they arrived, they were carefully recorded along with their hair colour and height and so on.
That's right. So tattoos were a great way to recognise someone. And, yeah, the most common tattoo was letters of the alphabet and, initials, names.
And what were the sorts of icons that were used?
Popular ones were anchors and hearts and people. They were probably the top three.
And the anchor, what did that represent?
Hope. Oh. It's a long-standing symbol of hope. That's right.
So you're a convict, you're coming over, it takes you forever to get here on a dreadful boat to go to Van Diemen's Land, and you think hope is the way to go?
Well, hanging on to hope was probably was the way to go.
Tell us about 31-year-old convict Isaac Comer. What was he transported for?
Oh, God. I think theft, actually, yes. But he was heavily tattooed all over, arms and hands and legs, thighs, tummy, and his penis.
Excuse me?
Yeah, they refer to it as his yard.
His yard?
That's right.
He had a yard tattoo.
He had a penis tattoo, but the authorities in 19th century sensibilities referred to his penis as a yard.
And was that common to be tattooed upon the yard?
No. Well, there was a handful of them, but no, not particularly common. But tattoos themselves were very common.
And what about the coming back to our lovely Isaac? Gosh, just the pain. I mean, I'm a woman, so I can only imagine, but I'm imagining. Was it common to be that heavily tattooed?
No. Isaac, he was pretty unusual, but tattoos were really common. So about 40% of men transported to Australia were tattooed, which was at the time a very high proportion of the population.
And how about women?
Yeah, about 15% of women were tattooed when they arrived.
And you reckon most of them got them on the boat on the way over?
Well, it looks that way, yes, because when you examine the records of convicts that shipped together, quite often they had the same tattoo.
Uh-huh. And there was also there were trends in tattoos, much as there are trends today. The Tahitian star gained popularity after sailors on Captain James Cook's Endeavour voyage had it inked. Where did they get it from? Tahiti, I imagine.
That's right, yeah, that was a mess group who decided to celebrate their arrival with the star. And, yeah, sailors continued to get that star tattooed for decades and decades later.
1-300-22-5576. We're talking about tattoos this morning and how people reacted. On the line is Simon Barnard, who's a tattoo historian, with me in the studio, Sophie Townsend, and her daughter Claire Stendel. Now, Sophie, you have a tattoo. Why do you have a tattoo?
I have a tattoo because of Queen Victoria, really. When my husband and Claire's dad died almost 5 years ago now, I was given a lot of books on grief and I ignored them all and read books on Queen Victoria. And because if you're going to be a widow, you've got to get expert advice. And she memorialised Albert for years and years after his death, and there were streets named after him and theatres built and statues. And really, if you're not the Empress of the British Empire, it's very hard to memorialise someone in that way. And I really wanted something to kind of remember Russell, my husband. And really the only way I could do it was a tattoo. So I got my initials and his initials tattooed on my foot. And that was my sort of Queen Victoria moment. And I don't regret it.
How long did you think about it before you did it?
Quite some time. And I thought about whether I wanted a symbol or whether I actually wanted his name and my name, and it was getting a bit long, and how I'd used the letters.
And you ended up with these lovely interlocking letters, R and S. How did you choose that design?
I think it just sort of evolved from, you know, I wanted something simple and I wanted it to be something he would have liked. Mm. He would have liked those, it's not too fancy, but it's dignified.
Mm. And what did your parents say?
My father said it made me look rough. I was like, you know, I'm a widow. I can't, you know, there's a certain dignity I was going for, but no, my father was shocked and appalled.
Any other reactions than notable?
My mother was worried that it would mean that I could never find another partner.
Oh.
But my reasoning was that I have two children.
So they're gonna pick that.
Yeah, and if someone can't get over the tattoo, then, you know, the children are going to be a real problem. So I just...
Claire, what did you think when Mum got that tattoo?
Yeah, it's a nice tattoo. I really like that tattoo and, you know, it was kind of fun going to the tattoo studio and sitting with Mum, even though she was in, you know, a lot of pain. But, yeah, I love it.
So you were in the tattoo parlour with her when she had it done?
Yeah, for a little while, not for the whole thing.
And I've never watched someone get a tattoo. What happens? How bad is it?
Well, it was the foot, and that hurts quite a bit, doesn't it?
So, 'cause there's not much fat on the foot. So
a lot of, you know, squinting and tears pooling, no crying.
It's not as bad as childbirth.
And how about Peachy on your upper arm? How much did that hurt? Because if you pinch your upper arm, it's pretty painful.
Didn't hurt at all.
Really?
Not at all.
And why did you pick peachy?
I like the word peachy. It's nice. It's kind of a nice little peachy, you know, just be peachy, maybe be a...
Pam's on the line from Glen Innes. Pam, what's your tattoo history?
Hi, Ellen. Look, I was living in Sydney at the time and my son was living in regional New South Wales with his dad. Anyway, my son used to come down to me for holidays, school holidays. He was probably 16 at the time, and he came and he said, "Mum, I want to get a tattoo." And I'm thinking, okay. He's now nearly 40, so it was some time ago. It was quite radical. So I said, okay, whereabouts? And he'd done his research and, oh, we can go to Newtown somewhere. I said, oh, have you got an appointment? No, we can't make an appointment. We just have to line up in the street. So I thought, well, if I don't go along with this, because at that stage, if you're under 18, and I don't know whether the same rules apply, I said, well, okay, yes, I'll go with you, thinking if I don't, he'll go to some dodgy place. So off we go, and here's me lining up in Newtown and King Street, and off we go, and he got in there and got his tattoo, and because there was a, I think, double price if you had it below the line of your undies. So he'd worn some fairly brief undies so he could have it where he wanted to on his butt. But anyway, all went well and it was all legit and it healed well. Anyway, sometime later, when he'd gone back to with his dad to school, he became very sick, nothing to do with the tattoo. It was some viral thing and he'd been bilious and so his dad thought, well, I have to, you know, he'd need to take him to hospital. Because he was very, very dehydrated. And he said, well, I'll shower him first. And, of course, this was the first time that Dad had seen the tattoo.
And how did he react?
Oh, well, you know, as a good dad would do under those circumstances, he was, very, very good about it and kind about it. And he is a very kind person. So
what a wonderful story, Pam. Almost the perfect circumstances for revealing that tattoo. A couple on the text service. My dad had a tattoo of my mum's name on his penis. Some years later, they divorced. Yeah.
It's regretful, isn't
that, it? Yes. You would regret that, wouldn't you? And you wouldn't even want to think about remove. I mean, let's just move on. Good morning. Definitely suggest no one use Queen Victoria as a grief model. She had a very morbid view of death and extended her grief for her whole life. An acquaintance who was adequate in the mammary area had many tattoos. Her last, myself and a mutual friend nicknamed her Titu. Someone else says it's so important to teach young people to respect their body autonomy. Getting a tattoo might just be part of that. Parents have to let young women control their own bodies, even if it's hard. I want to go back now to Simon Barnard, a tattoo historian. He's done a wonderful bit of research on tattoos from the convict era. I want to take you, Simon, to a drawing in the 1889 British Medical Journal of a tattooed arm, which had gone terribly, terribly wrong. How did the person end up with syphilis via a tattoo?
Yeah, the tattooist mixed ink with spittle from his syphilitically ulcerated mouth.
And the result?
Yeah, a bunch of soldiers copped it. And, yeah, well, it wasn't great.
So we've got this idea that he's spitting into the ink, stirring it around, and then, boom, putting it into their bodies and gently spreading syphilis through the whole of the Army Corps. Is that it?
Yeah, well, gently would be nice, but, yeah, that was the deal. And that was pretty common, I think, to tattoo in those sort of circumstances. That's right.
The stick and poke method was used. That's still in use today. Were there any hygiene issues more broadly with that?
Don't appear to be, really, which, I mean, it's hard to know, but according to records, it doesn't look like there was. And if tattooing, and it was certainly being carried out to a large degree, and if it was problematic, you'd think the authorities would have done something to stamp it out. And yet it doesn't turn up in any of the rules and regulations that governed colonial New South Wales and Van Diemen's Land.
And if you had seen a convict, with five stars on the inside of the thumb and forefinger, what would you have known about that person, Simon?
Well, it was traditionally five dots, And that would potentially mark them as a member of the 40 Thieves, a secret society of youths.
Well, it's not that secret if you've got it tattooed on your arm, is it?
Well, the webbing between your left forefinger and thumb. Well, it was for a while, and the authorities they came to the attention of the press in the late 1820s, and it was mostly kids,
And for those seeking inspiration from convict eras, let's just go through a few. A weeping willow, Simon?
Yeah, a symbol of death.
A flower pot.
Yeah, flower pot's really nice and surprisingly common. And that probably meant a variety of things ranging from resilience and separation to life anew, that kind of thing.
With a flower pot?
Yeah.
And does a skull and crossbones necessarily mean you're a convict or you're a pirate?
No, quite the opposite. Again, another mortality motif to mark someone's passing.
And are there any tattoos that you look at that you think now in this era where tattoos have suddenly become something that people have again in our world? We started off with the statistics, 1 in 4 women, 1 in 5 adults. Are there any that have stood the test of time that you think, gosh, that's something you could see walking the streets of any Australian city or town?
Yeah, most all of them. This stuff just handed on down from, one arm to the next. Yeah, I was in a pub the other day and I saw a guy with a true love knot on his arm and thought, wow, that's been around a long time.
Thank you so much for coming in. Simon Barnard, a tattoo historian.
Worries.
Claire Stendel and Sophie Townsend, very generous about talking about their stories. Thanks so much for coming in and showing us your tattoos. You can show us your tattoo on Facebook if you would like to. Go to the RN Facebook page. This from Ingrid on our Facebook page. I got my first tattoo just before I went overseas and tried to sell it by mum by saying it would help her identify my body if something happened to me. She was not amused. You're listening to Life Matters.